Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. My special guest today is a good friend and colleague, Professor Jonathan Gosling. Jonathan is Emeritus Professor of Leadership at Lancaster and Exeter Universities. Currently, he is the lead faculty at the Forward Institute and Director of Palumbra Limited. Jonathan has a lot of experience consulting all around the world. Currently, he is consulting to primary health services in South Africa. He also identifies as a sailor. Hi, Jonathan. How are you doing?
Hi, Simon. I'm very well, thanks. Very well. Fresh off the sea.
Lovely. We decided to do a podcast and you suggested the title Pleasures of Power. Tell me more.
Well, there's a lot been said and written and done about power, but it all seems to be somehow eviscerated. And I was asked once, when I showed signs of enthusiasm for taking on some new initiative and a new job or a promotion or something, and a colleague, Ken Parry, said to me, "Why do you want to do that?" And somehow I interpreted that question as very personal. He was like it was speaking to me. He said, "Jonathan, why do you want to do that?" Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking about what it was about me that had that desire and what the excitement was about. What pleasures did I expect from going for this job? And so I started thinking quite a bit more about what the different kinds of pleasures I'd experienced, and then I interviewed a number of other people and found it was really actually very surprisingly an almost sort of shocking subject. When I said to people, "So what's the pleasure you get from power?" People sort of would laugh and look inwards a bit, and then tell me some great stories. So I thought it's worth exploring a bit more and hearing your experience.
Yeah, well, we're both scholars of leadership, and we both have worked with leadership for a long time, and I guess we bump into power an awful lot. And I think you're right in highlighting it, because it's very, it's quite taboo, really. I mean, it gets aired in the critical literature a little bit, but in normative leadership studies, it's just not there, is it? It's kind of an embarrassing thing we kind of hide away from.
Well, I think it's as I say, it's eviscerated. It's talked about as, it's kind of explained as something that some individuals or groups or social classes or cliques do, or it's something that's built into structures and institutions. But the sort of messy, delightful, terrifying engagement of it and in it isn't really talked about much.
No. So tell me what you did think when you reflected on your own power, and when you started to question other people. What came up for you in those conversations and for yourself?
Well, I thought, first of all, in that context, about a repetitive pattern in myself to kind of discover myself through being efficacious. Through a sense that I can make things happen, I can do things, and I pursued that idea for a while around sort of a pleasure of agency, of being an agent in the world.
Yeah,
but I realized quite soon that this particular job and a number of projects and things I've taken on, if I really stop and think about it, I know that I'm not going to have that much influence. You know, I may, yeah, run another course, but it's not really going to change the culture of a company. I may lead a campaign, but it's not really going to stop climate change. And I realized after a while that quite a lot of this quite a lot of this excitement that I was loading into this idea of influence and agency was much more about my anxieties around my identity and a sense of feeling myself. Recognizing, discovering myself through that. And when I talk to other people, I think they recognize that. And there was quite a lot of differentiation. I have to say, people are quite different and not all the same kinds of pleasures. But I think one can differ from all the interviews I did and thinking about it and thinking about my own experiences throughout my career. I think there are pleasures of identity, of the self, of finding oneself, of, in a sense, creating, crafting oneself, which is affirmed through having a sense of potency. And then there are also other pleasures around influence. And I think there are some people who, much more than me, much more able, as it were, to really focus on what they are able to achieve or to influence, to make happen, and aren't pitched into things in the way that I am by their anxiety about their identity and their self. So I think there's another sort of category of pleasures, which are around pleasures of influence.
Yeah.
And then I began to think, well, look, there's an awful lot of power play and life of the powerful, which isn't really anxious about identity in oneself, and nor is it really with much hope of having a direct influence on things, or at least a traceable influence. It's more about kind of being in the game, being in the swim of things, being included in the mix of people where powering is happening.
Mm-hmm. I was coaching a leader recently, and I asked him the same question, you know, why do you want to do the job? You know, this is a big job you're taking on. And he thought a lot about it, and he said, because people listened to me. Like, his attachment to power was because people listened to him in a different way when he's a leader and he has power than when he's not a leader and when he doesn't have power. And I thought that was interesting, and that's part of my experience as well. When I take on leadership positions, people listen to you in a different way. Pay attention to it in a different way.
Yeah, like they're vesting in you an important part of an asymmetry. You speak, I'll listen, and then we know where we are.
and it, you know, not all leaders get that, and it depends on how you take up leadership, whether you're a coercive, whether you're use soft power, how you kind of use your charisma, all those things, of course. But there is that kind of, when you have positional power, people do project onto you some kind of authority and do listen in a different way. And they might listen with a kind of a fearful voice. They might listen with a more attentive voice. They might, depending on how you take it up, but certainly they listen to you differently, I think.
Yeah. That sense of reflecting on oneself as having, as being someone, having been listened to.
Yes.
Quite fun. Yeah. I associate that a bit with my experience sailing. I race catamarans and with a friend, and we're quite good, but we're not very good. And there are better people in our sailing club. And, you know, maybe once a year, perhaps every 2 years, we come first, we win a race. Mm-hmm. And coming away on those days, I have a sort of superhuman strength putting the boat away. And I'm much more confident in the shower. And I kind of get in my car and drive home with a sense of having huge amount of spare capacity on the days that I've been a winner. And I think that sense of oneself as powerful is really very pleasing.
It is, and of course it can be too pleasing, and then we get into narcissism and people's ego becoming grandiose. You know, there's a shadow side to that as well, isn't there, which we see around us a lot in the political world at the moment.
Yeah, I think all aspects, of course, of power have perverse expressions and extremes. I think, you know, for people who are perhaps more driven by this sense of having an influence, getting things done, moving an agenda along, less narcissistic, but maybe more obsessive, maybe more control freakery at the extreme.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that power is a dirty word in many ways? I mean, people wouldn't really say, "Yeah, I enjoy power." They'd use some cover up story usually to say, "I'm doing a job because I can help other people, because I can make a difference." There's a whole rationale of reasons which might be true as well, but people rarely would say, "I actually enjoy the power." Why do you think it's got a bad name in that sense?
Maybe it's because of the suggestions of its unbridledness. Of if the desire was fully experienced, if one were to sip just a little bit, one might become addicted to it, you know, like any other drug.
And people do.
Napoleon had this wonderful phrase when he was already emperor for some time. He said, he wrote in a letter to a friend of his, a journalist, said, "Power is my mistress, and I've loved her for so long and so much, I couldn't bear anyone else to have even a bit of her."
Yeah. That's very Napoleonic, isn't it?
It's very Napoleonic, but it's so self-aware as well.
Yeah, it's a very honest portrayal of power. I was thinking, when you talked about the pleasures of power, I was thinking about the Lacanian idea of how we take pleasure in our displeasure, how people kind of enjoy some of the painful aspects of power as well. I mean, when you're a leader, you know, you've coached leaders and I've coached leaders, and it's not all a fun game, is it? I mean, people really struggle and people go through much torment as well. But there's also an attachment to that part of it as well. It kind of grips people, doesn't it?
It does. This kind of caught in kind of inescapable and enticing but slightly sadomasochistic kind of engagement in that power. And there is something about the dynamic of domination and submission, which is, I think, exciting, particularly for some people more than others. But it's an important part, very important part of organizational life. Structures and processes are all about, not all, but many of them are to do with domination, rituals of domination and submission, like the annual performance review. Where people know, you know, they dress appropriately and they bring the necessary equipment in terms of their performance review criteria and forms to tick and this, that, and the other, and they play their part in it. To thrive in an organization and to kind of enjoy organizational life, I think you have to find in yourself something of these sadomasochist.
I think that's very interesting. I was struck, you know, I met you way back, maybe 2000 and early 2000s anyway, and at Lancashire University. And I came from a world which is not the corporate business world. I came from the public sector, sort of psychotherapy, nursing world. And I was struck by some of the language, you know, people talked about their subordinates. And I was like, you couldn't have used that language in the other world I came from, because it would have been seen as derogatory. And yet, how do you manage your subordinates? It's right in there with what you say around that kind of power domination matrix.
Yeah. I think another way to approach this is to think that things get done by people sort of, you know, organizing and gaining some kind of authority, using their authority, using their initiative. And these form a whole web of social processes, and that we all operate within, but we also operate on them. So we're caught up in organizational life and community life, and we're part of it and we're actors in it. And that acting is not always, but one of the things one's doing in that acting within so these social processes, these webs of processes, is powering. I think it's helpful to think about this as a verb. So, and of course, powering doesn't just explain everything about organizational life, but it, I think it's useful to think about the kinds of activities, the kinds of the ways of powering of using that verb. So an analogy might be if you're going for a walk in the park, you're walking, and you might pay attention to walking and moving your legs and your hips and swinging your body, whatever. But you're also breathing and watching and looking and listening and hearing and smelling and sensing and thinking, pondering. There's a whole load of other verbs describing you at that time. So which do you want to focus on and choose what, which you want to think about? And so you can switch, of course. You can concentrate on walking, or you can be listening or thinking or something. And I think the same is in organizational life. You can be, you're organizing, we're cooperating, collaborating, we're managing, and we're powering. So if one was to say, well, let's just for the moment look at the powering aspect, look at the doing of life as powering through that lens, what does it show us? Mm-hmm. And particularly, of course, that is relevant for people who are in leadership roles or who are relating to those or who are ambitious for leadership roles or who are, chairing meeting, trying to get an agenda through, trying to win a competition internally, get it or whatever. And then one can think more specifically about the different ways of powering. So you can, just we can think of different ways of thinking. Yeah. We can say, what are different ways of powering? And I think it's quite helpful then to delineate some of the tactics that people deploy in powering. And to some extent, coaching conversations can be about tactics. These are, let's consider what will be appropriate and effective tactics for powering in this circumstance.
Yeah, sure. And I think a lot of coaching conversations are about that. I mean, it's interesting you talk about powering, and the way powering is used as a verb more often is through empowering others, as if it's something we can do to others. But powering and taking that agency and thinking about the agency as a verb is very helpful.
Yeah, I think so. And I have been thinking a bit about how one might sort of categorize some different tactics. And I think there are some that are very much to do with the sort of person, and the relationships one has. So some of those tactics are around, for example, succession. Whose job am I going to get? Who's my mentor? Who am I after? And who am I looking after? To whom am I hoping and organizing to pass the work on to? Then there are other tactics around patronage. So who am I going to help, and how can I win patronage from others, and from whom? And I think tactics of patronage are very important and influential. And then there are also tactics around charisma and sort of managing one's image and impression on others.
Yeah.
Those sort of personal tactics. But there are others that are much more to do with practice, with action. The coup d'etat, the seizing of power, the boardroom coup or whatever, or sort of manipulating interest groups, divide and rule.
Yeah, or using your expert and technical power, I guess, if you as a tactic.
Yeah, sort of kind of mobilizing interest groups in that sense, and authority groups. Yeah. And then there are also the kind of perspective or culture that's dominant, and a kind of obvious one is often a tension between tactics around meritocracy and tactics around populism. Mm-hmm. So you know, are people going to get on because of their popularity, or are they going to get on because of their merit for some, you know, constructed category of merit? And
yeah,
and these ideologies are, I think they're both present in most organizations in reality. In many, the language and ideology of meritocracy is seen as sort of, you know, the proper way to do things. But of course, in actuality, when it really comes down to assessing someone's performance or their contribution, is a huge amount of that is, of course, subjective and constructed in conversations and through subjective ideas and perspectives.
Yeah, and through gender and through
race
and all those things come into play, don't they? In that power game.
Mm. So these are all things that you have to learn how to play. And I think some people are perhaps better at some tactics than others. Some people are more attuned perhaps to the more personal interpersonal tactics. Others are good at manipulating and divide and rule and all that sort of stuff.
And there's some people who are much more adept at doing that within organizations than others. I mean, you and I both have personal experiences of leadership in organizations, and perhaps we're not the greatest at that job. I mean, we've both been successful at one level, but we both end up outside the organization. Do you want to say something about your own experience of kind of bumping into power problems?
Yeah. You said, do I want to? I'm not sure I want to, but I will. I think that, well, I alluded before a bit to my kind of excitement about experiencing myself as powerful, as being able to gain and hold status and be part of a class, I suppose, or a caste of people who are in the know or on the inside track, who have information. Also a sense of my own voice being listened to, that sense of authority. I recognize that definitely in those pleasures. However, I also learned that my kind of response to the disciplinary, and I don't mean that in a kind of punishing way. I just mean the disciplines of organization, the rules and the regulations. I find it really difficult to respond to those in a kind of neutral and rational way. In the moment, I find myself a kind of reflex fight towards them, and have often got myself into really unnecessary sort of struggle.
Yeah, I mean, my experience, I mean, I called myself an anarchist when I was a young man and read a lot about anarchism, Bakunin and people, and really questioned the idea of authority and power. And yet at the same time, I was the captain of a rugby club and I took up leadership with some tenacity and some, and I was a well-liked leader. I was quite good at it, you know. And then I found myself in the health sector, and I found myself as a lower caste person, as a nurse in a medical setting. Doctors have a higher caste level, and your voice is only accepted up to a certain level. And I just found it very frustrating that you couldn't find your voice or use your full talents. And there's so many prohibitions, and I really struggled in that, and now working in big corporations and as an outside consultant and consultant to leaders, I look inside and I think I could never do that. I could never work in one of those systems. They're so conformist. And whilst people seem to have power at one level and take pleasure in the power we've discussed, I mean, my experience is they have very little power actually. That the kind of big power plays are kind of the ideology of the corporation and the hegemony of the system is so overpowering that actually you're kind of playing an inner theater game in a big system, which is quite totalizing, in fact.
Yeah, it's always remarkable that how difficult it is to find the place, the person, sitting in the chair that has the power to say yes or no, do it or not. Everyone's got to consult.
Yeah, and you know that's another power play. I think we don't look at enough in leadership and coaching studies. It is the hegemony of the system or the culture of a place or the rules of the game, and how you can only play within those rules and are actually quite set and quite difficult to challenge.
No, I think that's very interesting. So what I was saying before about the pleasures of power, the pleasures of identity or of influence or of sort of interaction, relationship, maybe those are all sort of sublimations for an abiding experience of impotence. Because the system is so overpowering, I've got to find my pleasures in these little ways.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think... And some people get close to bumping into the reality of the system, and they find it very painful, and they retreat from it, or they get out. So it's like you have to retreat to sort of manage yourself in that system to enjoy the small pleasures. And if you get a good salary, you get your golden handcuffs as well, sort of keeping you there. But it's interesting to coach people who are on the edge and struggling with it, and. I've met many of those who, you know, they start off very engaged in the process and then they end up kind of senior leadership levels and just wonder what happened to the last 20 years of their life and what they're doing. And there's a lot of people really questioning themselves in these big organizations.
Yeah. And questioning themselves and questioning the... It's almost as if thinking that I don't even know what the questions are anymore. That I've been pursuing answers to what I thought were the questions about how to get on. The question is how to get on, and I've been pursuing that question, creating answers for it all these years. And now I don't know what to ask anymore.
Yeah, and I find myself, I've been craving higher positional power, higher salary, higher status, and I've enjoyed the journey. Some of it, you know, some of it's kind of pleasurable. I led a good team, and you get these narratives. But many people kind of bump into it. But what next? And kind of what pleasure am I actually getting now from this position? And the question you said earlier on, what difference can I really make? Can I make a difference? Has all this been a game?
Yeah. And if there is a difference, what's it? What's going to last of it? Or is it totally bound up with me? Or when I'm dead and gone, has it gone with it? And I think this becomes very pertinent with, I think, facing the pandemic at the moment and the collapse and tragedies of brought upon us through climate change and biodiversity loss and so on. And then, in a sense, there's asking the same question or putting us in the same predicament on a global scale.
Yeah, yeah. And our political leaders are, you know, you can also see that struggle going on where you can take pleasure in minor successes. You know, you can get identity politics to make a few changes. You can pass a bill on gay marriage, which is an important thing, but you can't kind of address the big question of climate change, which is too big, too challenging.
Yeah. So perhaps I haven't thought of this before, but perhaps there is important to look at the possibility of some other kinds of pleasures in kind of impotence, in not being able to do these things.
Yeah, that's interesting to me as well. There's always been an interest in people who talk about being in praise of doing nothing. Or I've always been fascinated by monasteries, by monks who sit in a cell, or hermits, and people who manage to do very little in terms of productivity to the outside world, you know, but actually find some much deeper meaning in their lives. It's always been an interest.
Yeah. Well, I think there's also a different kind of language, which is not so much around power and potency as perhaps around sort of nurturing and fertility. Perhaps, you know, has a different kind of language and different sorts of pleasures associated with it, and is. But of course, you know, as everything else, as subject to defeat and loss, to limitation and so on. But a different kind of verb, a different being.
I remember you talking a while back, you were very interested in soap operas and soap operas in organizations as a metaphor for organizational life. And I think that's interesting. I think people do get caught up in the power games of their soap opera, their sadomasochism, their sublimations, their games with their boss and with their colleagues, their competitiveness. And it does create kind of a theater and a drama, which is engaging and can be meaningful and can provide something to wake up in the morning to and engage with. But stepping outside that is when we look at a bigger picture and stepping outside those bubbles. And I think that's a challenge. How can we kind of harness our power, and how can we think about powering and using the strategies for something more meaningful than the daily soap opera?
And in particular, can we do it in a way that is, it doesn't have recourse to a kind of fantastical romance of a kind of heroic salvation? That you know, so many change programs and things have, and as in kind of government policy change and things, have notion that, you know, we're going to change everything around and it'll be turmoil for a while, and then we'll settle back down. There'll be a time that's after the change when everything will settle down and be fine, which is a very strange kind of idea. You have to have that sort of structure if you're going to make a film that lasts for just 90 minutes or a couple of hours, because then you want to have an ending and people go away and the story's done. But real life ain't like that. That's a context in which I thought, well, maybe a lot of organizational life is about sustaining and continuing an engagement in the sort of narrative, the meaning-making efforts of a collection of people. And so that characterizes leadership of continuity and attention paid to that, which is, of course, going to be more and more critical as we come into big tumultuous changes and want to try and keep the semblances of civilized life that we have tried to enjoy and try to make them more evenly distributed for others. But it's a difficult way to construct a sense of self, which is not so associated to a kind of big heroic action, but rather is about a constant and continuous engagement in keeping things going.
Yeah. I mean, again, I that speaks to me of the monastic experience I've had, where you they talk about the life, and the life, of course, is this regular kind of happening with its kind of daily rituals. It's daily prayers and work rituals, and then the annual ones come about, your Easters, your Christmases, your patterns of life are set. And it's but they have a transcendent kind of a perspective of time, which is very interesting. So we need an ending, because our lives are kind of 70 plus 10 years or whatever they are these days. And they have a perspective which is past, present, and future merge in a very different way, and it liberates them in some ways. It's quite a different experience. Mm. I recall them being in a monastery where the monks were praying, and they were remembering some brothers from the same monastery 300 years previously, holding them in their minds.
Mm.
And I found it very powerful.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that's a sense of continuity and a collectivity that transcends the self. Do you think that will be, can that be sort of mobilized or brought to the rest of us in times of great anxiety and turmoil?
Well, I think it should be in a sense. I think we've lost it. I think in the modernity is and the secularization of society has lost that transcendent, you know, the idea that we're disenchanted. Weber's idea of the disenchanted modern world, and I think we need to be re-enchanted somehow. I think we need to re-enchant ourselves, and I think that comes from kind of letting go of a very kind of secular, modern way of thinking, which is very bounded and very, very fixed, very linear.
Yeah. So, so let's go back to our terminology around pleasure. How would you describe, do you think, the pleasures of the monastic life?
Well, I think the monastic life is like any other life. I think monks go through huge crisis, existential crisis. Like, what am I doing here? I remember reading one piece from Thomas Merton, I think, and it was about how if a monk knew he's going to be a monk when he was 70, would he still be a monk when he was 20? You know, kind of you go in with this idealistic idea of what it is to join the monastery when you're a younger man without the full kind of knowledge of what the years of prayer mean. So I think there's, I wouldn't idealize the monastic life, and there's all sorts of different experiences. But the pleasures of it, for the monks I've met who actually do gain pleasure and do find their selves at home in the monastery and find their selves at home with the monk within, have kind of transcended that need for superficial pleasures. They do engage in a deeper sense of pleasure, of brotherhood, of sisterhood, of togetherness, of presence of what they interpret as God, the sense of a transcendent kind of a being, which often involves kind of nature as well. So their daily work is very manual, bread making, you know, working on the farm. There's something about inhabiting their lives in a way which is brings some deep pleasure, rather than the soap opera of a busy workplace where you there's a lot of hubris and noise and adrenaline, and but not that deeper kind of satisfaction of being part of a community and an ecosystem and a world which is transcendent to the kind of very present world we see and live in.
Yeah, so I think that's made me think, if I go back to the story I opened with of a friend asking me why I wanted to take on this job, perhaps another way I might have answered it would be because I want more.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe what you're saying is the monastic life is sort of attainable if one stops wanting more.
I think that's very helpful. I wrote a recent thing called In Praise of the Flask. I might actually make a podcast of it. It's my experience of the COVID lockdown, whereas pre-COVID I would spend my life jumping in and out of cafes, drinking cappuccinos and flat whites and working in cafe society, and that was my office. And when all that shut down, I ended up filling a flask up with coffee and cycling into the hills and sitting quietly, either with a friend or on my own or with a family picnic, and having a much deeper, much more satisfying experience. So the first was kind of that buzzy experience I was describing, and the second was getting back to something within nature, not stuck in a coffee shop, you know, just me, the flask, some fresh air, or friends and family, and a much deeper satisfaction. So yeah, I think that is something which is harder to grasp when you're in the hubris and the busyness of the world.
Hmm.
Jonathan, we're coming to an end, and in my podcast, I ask guests what, from this conversation and from their experience, does it? What advice can they give to the audience around living a good life and creating a good society? And I wondered if you had any reflections on that.
Well, the conversation has brought me to thinking about this desire for more. And is it? I'll have to think more about how to recognize in myself and make choices. I think, like you're saying, to choose the flask, using the metaphor.
Yeah.
And I think that. I'd like to invite listeners to this to think about their own pleasures in powering, and also to think about the kind of pleasures that others are having and what's available to them. I think it might be helpful in coaching, and it might be helpful in choosing how to help and mentor others. One part of the thing is to think about the pleasure that that they can gain in the directions they're taking.
Very much so. Mm. Jonathan, it's been lovely talking to you as always.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Simon.
Good, go well, and I'll speak to you and hopefully see you soon.
One day. I hope so indeed.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.